Hello and welcome to another episode of Art Supply Posse, a podcast about art supplies and the people that use them. I'm Heather Rivard, and I am joined today by Anna Reinert and our special guest, Bob Atkins, who is the owner and flight director of Skylab Letterpress. Thank you all for tuning in to another episode, and thank you as well to Art Snacks, who is once again sponsoring this episode of Art Supply Posse. How are you doing, Anna?
Just fine. I should probably come clean and admit that Bob's also my husband and recording from the kitchen.
Hey, Bob.
Hello. Good evening.
He has some other qualifications. And right before we hit record, also identified himself as longtime listener, first time caller, which I had to say
Truth.
Over again because it made me laugh. So we're going to go over some follow up from our last couple episodes, and then we're going to talk printmaking, and Bob's going to talk a little bit about his work in particular at Skylab, and maybe cover some printmaking in general. We kind of had that thought after our little bookmaking conversation
Sure.
last week, since printing techniques was one of the things that came up. So first up in follow up, Anna, we got our wrists slapped for being a bunch of Mac heads.
Yes, it was brought to our attention that we specifically spoke about Mac applications last week when we talked about doing digital work by our good friend Dan Bishop at Karis Customs, that we didn't mention any PC applications in regards to graphic software. So he mentioned a few that he knew about, that he used, but that there were many, many others that we did not mention, and that if anyone had any recommendations, to certainly bring them to our attention. But he specifically mentioned the Corel Graphics Suite. There's a paint and draw application that you can get in the suite for $449. There's also ArtRage, which is both for Mac and PC for $49, and an application that used to be called Manga Studio, but is now called Clip Studio Paint Pro or Paint EX, which is $47 for the Paint Pro and $209 for the Paint EX, which includes 3D software.
Yeah, I've heard good things about the Manga Studio. I think that might be the program that the fellow that draws Penny Arcade uses. He's a kind of famously a big PC user. So Dan's looking out for all you PC users out there. I'm sure there are some of you. And apologies for our operating system bias.
Well, and when I went through the software, I knew that you used a Mac. So when I was looking specifically for Mac software. So it wasn't a bias completely.
Yeah, that's true. It was sort of in spirit.
I was looking specifically for you.
Recommendations, and she knows what sort of computer I have. She's just a good friend like that.
But yes, I probably should have done my homework and looked for software that would help everybody.
If I need a little bit more cred, I would like it to be known that before I bought my first Mac laptop like a year ago, I was running Ubuntu on my computer. So that's pretty hardcore.
Cool.
I mean, I have used computers that aren't Macs before. So Pat Oblak also had a little bit of a follow-up on the software. There's a sort of introductory level Photoshop program that's available for a one-time purchase called Photoshop Elements. I was a little bit familiar with this, but I'm sure you are as well, Anna.
Yeah, I'm. A lot of times it used to ship with like Wacom tablets and some other sort of entry level hardware, like a scanner, that kind of thing. But yeah, sort of an entry level kind of taste of what Photoshop was like to get people interested in it. But yeah, Pat said that you can purchase it for about $80 online. But that you can also find older versions of the software.
Yeah.
So if you've never tried it, it's probably a good way to get introduced to Photoshop, sort of the basic tools.
Yeah, and Photoshop is Like many of the Adobe programs, one of those things where I think most of us probably only use a very small percentage of the tools anyway. So something like Elements might be a good option. And it does have that nice element of just being a one-time purchase. It seems not to be super the direction that Adobe is moving in long term, but for now it's still available in a little corner of their website. It's not super easy to find, but we'll put the links in the show notes so you guys can go right there if you're interested in it. We also had a really lovely long email from a listener named Sasha, and she was responding primarily to our Big Magic episode, and she brought up a quote that I think it's passed around quite a lot in sort of artistic communities online, but I thought was worth mentioning here for maybe somebody who wasn't familiar with it. Had you seen this before, Anna, this quote from Ira Glass?
Yeah. I love this quote.
It's pretty good. You want to give it a read?
Sure. Nobody tells this to people who are beginners. I wish someone told me. All of us who do creative work, we get into it because we have good taste. But there is this gap. For the first couple of years you make stuff, it's just not that good. It's trying to be good. It has potential, but it's not. But your taste, the thing that got you into the game, is still killer. And your taste is why your work disappoints you. A lot of people never get past this phase and they quit.
Yeah, and a lot of people have made like little animated videos of that quote, so we'll put one of those in the show notes. But yeah, it's such a good point. Like, you only ever pick up a pencil if you've gotten to that part where you're really loving animation or really loving illustration, and that makes it all the like worse when you sit down to make something for the first time and you're so aware of this like gaping void between what you have the ability to do and what the people that you really admire have the ability to do. But it's kind of a necessary part of the process.
Yep. Yeah.
Do you have that?
So, speaking of which.
So I am like so down the rabbit hole of digital lettering. When we talked last week, I sort of had this brainwave that I need to think more seriously about getting my work into a digital form that I can reproduce with quality, you know, something more than just snapping a picture of it with my phone. And so I took some of the lettering that I've been doing and feeling like more and more confident with and tried to put that into Illustrator. It was such a disaster.
This Illustrator is one of the hardest programs to learn how to use. It has a really, really steep learning curve, but once you get it, it's one of the best programs to learn. But the learning curve is really steep getting into it. So don't be discouraged. It just takes a while to get the hang of it because Bezier curves are very frustrating.
Yeah, and a few days later, I am in a much better place, but the day after we recorded, I think I messaged you in our Slack, so many curse words in my heart of hearts right now, trying to set up a digital art workflow, I know nothing. And we've sort of by default decided, you know, maybe not to use so many curse words on the show, but in that moment, I was like, if I had to talk about this right now, it would just be a long series of like bleeped out, frustrated expressions.
Yeah.
I did really enjoy Jessica Hish's class on Skillshare. I bought a month of membership there, and she talked about really being disciplined about the number of anchor points you use with this little like pen tool shape that you make. And that was great because what I had done initially was just scan things in and try to like live trace it and then work from there. And it was like one of the first things she said was, you can use your sketches as a background, but don't try to live trace them. That's just going to be a disaster. It's live trace is kind of like an automatic way to try to take a raster image and turn it into a vector. And it really don't work that good.
It does, but part of what you need to do is go into the advanced settings and really dial that down a lot. If you want to keep go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, if I may, we use Illustrator 90% of the time at our print shop. And we have dialed in some trace settings and just a lot of trial and error, because a lot of clients will send us raster images and we have to make it vector art, which we need to get the best film, the best quality, nice clean lines. And so, yeah, trial and error, you set up some trace settings and you just like name it something, and that's your go-to default.
Well, that's good to know. Yeah. I didn't even know that's a whole like side of the Adobe programs. I just kind of use them clean, but I know there's a whole thing of like setting up your swatch boards and setting up your like custom actions and like custom settings and things that you learn if you do it every single day for your job. I was thinking about you a lot, Anna, though, because I was like, I had just had my face in my computer for like 4 hours, and I was like, maybe this is what Anna's life is like when she's at work.
When we switched from CS5 to Creative Cloud, they changed how the live trace settings, like how that whole panel was set up. And in doing that, none of the live trace presets transferred over. And there was almost a mutiny at Hallmark. Because the people in the lettering studio had so many presets that they had built for different types of lettering that they would scan in. And, you know, for, you know, rough, like brush lettering, they had certain settings. For real clean calligraphy, they had certain settings. And none of those settings would transfer. And I mean, like, those people were like, they were going to kill the people at Adobe. They were going to come at them with torches.
Is Adobe headquartered in Chicago? Am I remembering that correctly?
No, they're out in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
They're out in San Francisco.
At least that's kind of far away from Kansas City.
Yeah, if they were that close, yeah.
It might have been a road trip.
So, yeah, so people have had to slowly rebuild new presets.
Oh my gosh, if they went to protest, Anna, their protest signs would be so well lettered.
They would have been beautiful, and they would have put their little vector points where they would needed to be. So, but anyway, yeah. So yes, Illustrator's the devil, but once you learn how to use it, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And at this point I am having fun, and I'm trying to kind of finalize an alphabet of, okay, this is like my basic brush lettering alphabet that I can use. And then once I have all the letter forms, then I could just, you know, sort of like command drag them or control drag, whatever it is, and form like quick words and stuff. So it's been a fun project. I'm learning a lot, but yeah, it's a steep learning curve.
Have you guys talked about maybe like iPad programs?
Not yet, not in detail, but we have plans.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. I did a little bit of that because my little sister has an iPad Pro that I'm the guardian of right now, and what I found is that it's a nice sort of just like mucking about in like a notes app, but I think that it would be a much bigger thing to actually set up a workflow where I could get disciplined images out of there. You know, I think that there are like vector programs for the iPad. Do you guys use that in your workflow at the shop at all?
No, Bob? No, never. But I'm intrigued by it. And we have an old school, I think it's an iPad 2 second generation thing. And we have, is it a 53 pencil?
Oh, yeah.
So we have that, and at the shop, we have the Creative Cloud. I went ahead and ponied up $49, and we have access to all the programs all the time. It seems redundant because I'd bought all the stuff before, but it's nice to have them completely updated and have access to a ton of stuff. As a result, I had no qualms getting the Adobe Draw program for the iPad, which hooked up with the Adobe account, so I could draw stuff and it would save it as vector form and upload it to and it uploads it to my Adobe account, which I can access at work and import it into Illustrator. And the cool thing about that Adobe Draw program is it allows you to draw in layers and shift around the layers and export the whole thing as one project. But again, it's the whole digital tool interface is kind of awkward for a lot of people.
That is worth looking into, because I've been thinking about investing in either a Wacom tablet or an iPad Pro and trying to figure out sort of the benefits of the two. And one of the I wasn't sure about how could I get iPad work into really good, like, professional apps and be able to pull that in and work with it. So I will definitely be snooping around with this draw program. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I was surprised. Not that I'm a Luddite, but a lot of times the tech, I just kind of lose patience.
There's a reason maybe that your shop is full of...
it's pretty analog.
Shall we say, not the most cutting edge way of doing reproduction.
I like to think of it as a hybrid shop.
Yeah. Yeah. In other news, it is November 1st we're recording. The show will be out on November 2nd, but that means no Woot. More Inktober. Yeah, Yay. Happy Halloween.
Oh boy, I'm so glad to see the back end of October.
Are you done, or do you still have a couple letters to fill up? I admit I haven't been following with the closest of attention.
Technically, I only did 30 drawings, but I finished my alphabet.
So you are done.
As far as I'm concerned, that baby is done.
I liked your little innovation for X. I saw that one. X is for charts. Very clever.
Yes. That was advice from one of my friends, because on knitting charts, they use X's to indicate codes on knitting charts. So,
ooh. Elizabeth Zimmerman, the founder of modern knitting. That's yes. a prestigious title.
Yes.
That's a really lovely little portrait, too.
Thank you.
Well done.
Although one of my friends who commented mentioned that I misspelled her last name, and I was like, oh, no, two N's in Zimmerman. So eventually I will go in and digitally correct the spelling.
That it's supposed to be just one?
Two N's in Zimmerman.
At the end? Oh, well, yeah. That'll be really easy to fix. That's good.
Yeah.
You can just grab it over.
Yep. I will just duplicate that N.
Z is a weird letter form. I got to Z in my little alphabet project, and it's just the script that I'm working with is, you know, it's like a watercolor script. It's really flowy, and Z is all like, you can't really do it in a scripty way. So I'm still working on how to make that look less awkward.
So you have a couple more drawings to do before you're finished?
Well, no, I missed probably 3 days total in the end, maybe 4 days. But I'm chalking that up to, you know, like imperfect execution. But I am going to keep up the rhythm of trying to post something every night, you know,
Good.
Like doing drawing every night. That's become a really lovely part of my routine. I kind of like do all my chores and shut up the house and then sit down at my desk. And sort of the earlier I can get to all of those chores, the more time I have to draw. So it's a nice way to send out the evening. I will say it was nicer when I was writing on paper. Now that involves staring at my computer, I might need to have a little bit more calm down time after I walk away from the Illustrator.
Cool. So, well, congrats to everybody who participated in Inktober, whether you completed all 31 drawings or only did 5 or 10. It was a good challenge, and I'm looking forward to doing more projects like that.
And that's something we'll be talking about over the next couple of weeks is Anna and I will be putting our heads together and thinking about what can we do to sort of promote regular creating within the little podcast posse and share it with each other. So if you've got any clever ideas, let us hear it. Otherwise, we'll probably have some more to say on that subject in a couple weeks.
Absolutely.
Did you want to talk about this last little tidbit of news?
Oh, yeah, I found this cool little thing this week. Emily Winfield Martin, who is known online as, I think she goes by like the Inside the Black Apple, I think is usually her website or blog. But she did a new children's picture book called The Littlest Family. And on this website, I found some process drawings that she did of like her pencil sketches through like kind of her final paintings for this children's picture book. And I thought it went along with a lot of what we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks about sort of the process of drawing and how things go from ideas to sort of rough sketches to sort of final artwork.
Oh my gosh, I need to get this book. It says it's about a family that makes lists, and this says, not wanting to be left out, Grandpa made lists of his greatest admirers and most fearsome enemies. The cat did the same.
So yeah, the website is called blaine.org, and we'll put a link in the show notes. But yeah, it's a little storybook about like three little bears or something, the littlest family. So she does these really cute little illustrations, but it's just kind of cool to see sort of the process of her drawings of these little sort of pencil sketches and sort of how she laid everything out. And you can see like color swatches of sort of picking out her colors for her paintings and everything. It's just really nice to see sort of the process. And I know a lot of people had asked, like, how do things sort of go through the process of sort of the rough drawings to the final paintings and stuff. So I just thought it was interesting and very, very fitting to a lot of what we've been talking about like how do things become the final thing?
Yeah. Oh, man. So true.
So
very cool. All right. You want to tell us about something else that's cool,
Anna? Yeah. I'm going to tell you guys about Art Snacks. This episode of Art Supply Posse is brought to you by Art Snacks, who offer monthly subscriptions of full-size, high-quality art supplies. As many of you know by now, each box includes 4 to 5 full-size art supplies that are thoughtfully curated and delivered right to your door. The November box has already started to ship. I got my shipping notification on Monday, so we should be seeing what those new Art Snacks branded art supplies will be soon. If you want to start getting your own Art Snacks art supplies, you can subscribe today and get in on the December box. And don't forget about the new Studio Collection. They're bigger, better, and snackier than ever. The Studio Collection contains 7 full-sized premium products, including 2 exclusive and new brands never before featured in an Art Snacks collection. The Studio Collection features stuff that just doesn't fit into regular monthly boxes. The Studio Collection will be $129 and includes shipping in the U.S., Pre-orders are ending on November 30th, and the boxes will start shipping on December 5th. They'll take about 3 to 10 business days for the domestic boxes and about 8 to 15 days for international boxes, so they'll arrive in time for the holidays and would make a perfect gift for you or someone you love.
Yeah, they must be running out of brands, man. They keep on saying, like, new exclusive brands, but I guess there is a whole lot of art supplies out in the world.
There are. Oh, and don't forget to use the coupon code ArtSupplyPosse to get 10% off your first month subscription.
Yeah, pretty soon.
Goodness. Can't believe I forgot the important
part. That's all right. Art Supply Posse, 10% off, and then you can get in on the fun waiting game, because now it's like countdown to boxes are here. It's going to be really fun. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I am really excited to see what their new product is. I'm also really interested to see like how they've branded it. If they're like calling it Art Snacks, like if that's the brand, or if they've done a different brand. It'll be interesting. Yeah, different I know that's name. Something that they pay attention to and care a lot about is how they talk about things and the design that goes into it.
Is it going to be called Crunchy?
I don't know. Have to find out. But yeah. Per usual, we will get our boxes and then give you guys a little bit of time to get yours before we spill the beans on the show. So,
absolutely.
All right, so. Mr. Bob, we've been yakking with our follow up, but our main topic is to hear a little bit about Skylab and how you came to be a printmaker. Do you want to just start talk a little bit about your background in education and school and whatnot?
Absolutely. And I apologize for all the editing you might have to do.
No problem.
Sure. Anna told me last week you wanted to talk about printing, and I was pretty excited because I do have a bachelor's in fine arts and printmaking from Auburn University, War Eagle. Had to get that in. And
now that's going to have to be edited out.
I did not get a full art degree. Mm-hmm. I had like a little half art degree, but my like for my art degree, I had to go up to like a certain level of intensity in a certain, wow, being super clear here, Heather, I took a bunch of art classes, but I had to pick a field where I would take like the 300 and the 400 level classes, and printmaking is what I did that in. So I got to get into like the Yale Art School. They have like a big print shop in the basement, and I got to like muck around in there and like drop some copper plates and some vats of acid and do the whole little thing. So I'll be following along at least in the broad strokes of what we're talking about.
Cool. Sure. Well, I'd never had art in high school and assumed it was for gifted people. And somehow I got into art in college. A couple of friends kind of talked me into taking some classes, and it just kind of snowballed from there. And I got into printmaking because it seemed very technical, and it seemed at the time that I didn't have to have, you know, God-given drawing skills to make something that looked cool.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I was appropriating images and using a lot of pop imagery and transferring images to plates and stuff like that. So I really got onto the whole aspect of inking up paper and, you know, like you, dropping plates in acid and carving up plates and getting into lithography, which is really cool. And so that's what I got my BFA in, that, and it was a lot of fun. And then just like years pass. Pages turn. I took one design class at Auburn. I took a couple of design classes at Auburn, just enough to realize that it wasn't for me. But we had a computer class at the time, which was like still in its infancy, and I learned enough to bum around and somehow wound up the design job in Albuquerque with Anna years later. And this is kind of rambling. I guess you can edit most of this out.
No, this is the good stuff. I like hearing about how people get from A to B. So after school, you ended up getting a design job.
Well, no, actually, after school, I went to work for Kinko's because that was all you could do with a BFA. And
down the road. Down the road. After school, dot, dot, dot.
After school, dot, dot. Yeah. Working at Kinko's is great. It was you had a 401k. You didn't go home smelling like food. You had a very clean environment. I got to wear, you know, vintage ties to work. And I got to work with, you know, brand new color copiers, which were really cool at the time. And I kind of got swayed by a lot of technology at that point. Coincidentally, I met Anna in Knoxville during that job. So, yeah, we move out to Albuquerque, and she winds up getting a job at an alternative newspaper. She's the art director there, and They needed a warm body to lay out ads, and that was me. So I came in and learned how to do Cork, and that was cool. It was just kind of fun to me. It wasn't really like a profession. It was just like, oh, I could slap some type together and, you know, make something that looked kind of neat.
So you guys were working at the same paper?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Alibi. That's cool. Used to be called New City. So years later, we're in Chicago, and we're getting to the point where I'm running into letterpress. Anna was working for Carlos Segura at T26 Type Foundry, and I was slumming there doing some in-between work, and I ran into a guy named Bruno Rohner, who comes from, his dad was a pretty big printer in Chicago, and Bruno was a print rep at the time, and he was doing some letterpress on the side, and the year was 1997, and nobody was really doing it. Julie Holcomb was probably the biggest name out in San Francisco. Boxcar Press might have been starting up, but there wasn't really anybody in Chicago doing this. And I saw this letterpress that he was doing, and I was intrigued. It kind of hit a really clean design aesthetic that I really enjoyed, plus the nitty-gritty meat and potatoes kind of inking up paper that I, you know, got my bachelor's in at Auburn.
So, and roughly when was this?
1997.
So a fair bit before like the last 10 years of like Uber, like everybody loves big old Heidelberg presses and buying them up and all that stuff. So a little bit before that current wave of nostalgia about press.
It was way back, and we didn't have any, the internet was in its infancy as well. We didn't have a lot of online resources to call information from. So we had to do a lot of R&D this first couple of years and figure out how things work best for us. It was a very small shop. I think there was at the most four employees before we left, where I left in 2001. And we were doing all the wedding invitations for Paper Source at the time, and a lot of big clients like that. And we had a lot of large design agencies come to us in Chicago, and we had to figure out how to approach selling our work to them. And there was a whole, like you said earlier, work process of how things worked in the letterpress world, because it was very new to a lot of designers in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And it's still new to a lot of designers now.
Well, and one of the things that Runner Letterpress really started kind of introducing to the design community was photopolymer plates, which allowed designers to actually create on computers rather than having to use like wood type and lead type and that kind of stuff. So it made it so that you could, I mean, like that was a big part of what you guys
True.
Were doing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, Carlos was all about digital type, and a lot of his fonts were kind of the late 90s aesthetic was kind of, how do you describe it? Kind of techno or very grungy.
Yeah. So taking that very modern looking design and actually being able to do it with this, you know, sort of 19th century technology, you know, printing it with 19th century technology, but, you know, 21st century design mm-hmm. aesthetic.
And Bruno's background was very much in the commercial world of commercial printing. And that was our whole angle, was just delivering high quality letterpress ephemera to design firms around the country. Mm-hmm. And the photopolymer really allowed us to do that in-house and really dial in all the specifics that the process requires, and meld it with Heidelberg windmills. I think we had a Vandercook that we never used. We just had it, but because at the time nobody was, the Hatch was going on. I know Brady Fest here in Hammer Press was doing his thing too. But you could still get Vandercooks pretty cheaply back then. But we had
In Chicago mm-hmm. was the first time that you worked in a proper like letterpress studio, but you were still trying to figure out how that fit into the larger world of design professionals and production technology.
Yeah, it's very succinct. the first I'd actually heard of letterpress was in Knoxville in 92, and Kevin Bradley was a friend of my roommate at the time, and he was just starting to get into letterpress. He, of course, went on to start Yeehaw Letterpress, and now he's out in L.A. doing the Church of Type, and he does a really, really beautiful. If you don't know Kevin Bradley's work, it's absolutely beautiful.
And he does a lot of like linoleum woodcuts.
Okay. Yeah.
And oh yeah, mm-hmm. This is cool.
Yeah, and he has very kind of southern. I don't know, how would you say it? There's some irony there. There's some mm-hmm.
history, illiterate. Storytelling. Yeah, storytelling.
Storytelling. That's it in a nutshell. It's not as, you know, Hall of Country, Country Hall of Music, Hatch aesthetic.
Yeah, this is interesting. Yeah, yeah. I can see some of that. It's got like almost a little bit of like a Southwest vibe, but the content is so much different. You know, it's not like a bunch of cactuses. It's just lots of different stuff.
No, it's very, I mean, Kevin and I went to college together, and yeah, he, that sort of quirky southern fried storytelling that he did has kind of developed over the years. Mm-hmm. It's very, very quirky.
I think in the early 90s there was a nexus of, I'm sure they're still there, of southern kind of arty freaks who have no outlet in the deep south, and they kind of pool together and they develop their own language, like much like Howard Finster's work, Kevin's work, Scott Peake down at Standard Deluxe. They kind of congregate and kind of wind up knowing everybody. But Kevin's work is very, very literate, very, very authentic to him.
Yeah, that's something that I am really interested in. like if you're from like the Midwest, for instance, which is where I grew up, where all of us live, sometimes it feels like my life doesn't fit here, you know, because I'm like at home sticking my face in Illustrator and worrying about that and like recording my podcast and talking to my friends on the internet, and everybody I know like feels like everybody lives in New York or like back where I went to school. And I'm sort of hungry for a way of integrating those two things, that I'm a creative professional and I care about these things and I like to put art on my walls, but I also really love the place where I'm from and I want those things to be the same. Like I desperately don't want to be these like two different people kind of poorly spackled together.
And I think a lot of communities are working a lot harder to sort of find those communities. Because you see more and more of the sort of like local craft shows, local, sort of art collectives where groups of people who are creative are sort of banding together and sort of trying to develop those networks of, you know, sort of local pride, local creative communities. Like we're seeing more and more of that here in Kansas City as more people are trying to build that and showing that there's this huge creative community here and how much talent and how much creativity. And, you know, it's like each community is slowly, you know, and some communities take longer because they're smaller mm-hmm. communities. There aren't necessarily as many people. It takes longer. There may not necessarily be all fine artists. Maybe there are musicians and dancers and, you know, slam poets. You're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Your community might end up, it might be something that you're not expecting.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's another way of forming the question that I'm interested in is, you know, I have all these like people that I know from school who like move to these like half dozen different cities in America. And I sort of have an idea of like what it looks like to be like in the 10 years after you went to liberal arts school and be living in a big American city. But it's like, okay, so that's what it looks like for those people. But like my neighbors who are, you know, like 30 and 40 and 50 and 70, and many of my neighbors happen to have also like grown up in like really extreme poverty. Like, what does it look like for them to be fully artistically expressed? You know, it's not going to be the same way. And so like if Owosso has a vibrant art scene, it's not going to be like, oh, I feel like I'm in Brooklyn. It's like, no, you'll feel like you're here. Like it'll have something to do with these people's experiences and their lives.
Yep. So it might be somebody who does amazing crochet or lace or some, you know, I mean, it might be some, you know, some 70-year-old woman who does amazing embroidery or, you know, I mean, it just might be something you're not expecting.
Yeah, and those kind of like folk arts, like fiber work that like bridge like, that space between utility and expression.
You know, like the G's Ben quilt ladies.
Oh, who are these people? I haven't heard of this.
The G's Ben mm-hmm. quilt. It's a town in Alabama.
Yeah,
in Alabama, right?
Kind of west of Montgomery, really small town, and they have a tradition of making quilts and just beautiful quilts. And I think a documentarian or document. Is that the right word? Documentarian?
Yeah, I think so.
Filmmaker went there and started. I don't know how they came around.
Somebody found out about these women that, you know, I mean, basically just in totally impoverished community of women who made these amazing, almost postmodern
these are beautiful
quilts.
Like they all seem like, yeah, they're from a school of thought, but they're different.
And people who were not formally trained as artists or anything like that, but make these amazing quilts. And they, I mean, like now, like artists and go and train with these women who make these quilts. And these ladies are like, what? I just make quilts. Like, go away. Leave me alone.
Oh, this is like one of my favorite things I've seen in a long time. This is beautiful.
We actually, at Hallmark, they actually have... actually have prints that somebody made based off of the G's Ben quilts. And they're beautiful intaglio prints based on the shapes of the of the print of the
and
quilt
I think there are also
pieces.
Some postage stamps, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so.
That would make sense.
So it came all the way back around to printmaking. Go figure.
Tying that in briefly, Scott Peake from Standard Deluxe does silkscreen in the Deep South and just outside of Auburn in the small hamlet of Waverly, Alabama. He's celebrating his 25th anniversary this week, and he did a nice set of G's Ben's silkscreen prints. Anyway.
Very cool.
Anyway, you said you live in Owosso?
I do, yeah.
Okay, there's a great engraving company there called Owosso Graphic Arts.
Yeah, I know some of the folks that run the place.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I think we spoke about it maybe briefly on the show before, but yeah, it's like a tiny little building. I could walk there from my house. It would take me a half hour, but
wow.
I could get there.
Cool.
Yeah, they do like metallic inks and stuff, so yeah.
Yeah, they do magnesium dyes. I've had one order there before. I called them up the other day. We were getting a quote on something.
Ah, that's so cool. That makes
yeah,
me so happy.
They're very well known.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, you know, they tell you in town, like, do you know that there's this like real famous shop over there? And it's like, sometimes it's like cheesy hometown proud where you're like, what do you mean by famous? Like, are you for real? But yeah, I've run into people out in the world who know Owosso Graphic Arts. So that's pretty cool.
Rad.
So do you have some more questions for Bob about Skylar
Yeah,
Letterpress?
Well, maybe we can kind of like fast forward. I know that you went, I think originally when you guys were in Kansas City, you were teaching. But when did you first start Skylab?
I started late 2006. I'd taken a Kauffman Foundation Fast Track Entrepreneur class. That was about 10 weeks of just sitting in a room with maybe about 100 other people, and you break down to different groups and you talk about your project with the business you want to start. And these entrepreneurial classes, they're great to just kind of flesh things out. And, you know, even though I knew how I wanted to set up my shop, the whole business angle I wanted to approach, it's nice to talk to other people and just kind of get their vibe on, you know, your idea, like, this is completely crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And you develop business relationships, and I've got a really nice friend I met through this thing, and he started a pretty successful coffee shop, and we've just kind of had a nice little business relationship ever since. Our businesses are rarely cross paths, and we can talk freely about business ideas and approaches to mm-hmm. new things without stepping on each other's toes.
Oh, that's cool. Are you the sole owner, or do you have any other partners or
no, I'm the sole owner.
Close collaborative? Yeah.
I have one employee right now. She's my right hand. I have, I'm an S corporation. A lot of people operate as an LLC, but I opted for the S corp because I think there's some unique tax breaks in there.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you what they are now, but I knew.
But at the time,
yeah,
it was a great idea.
Yeah, it's still good.
It's still good. Those things I thought are still true. Mm-hmm. And so what kind of work do you guys primarily do? What kind of machines do you use? And then what kind of work is that suited to?
Well, we're primarily a commercial letterpress print shop. And there's a lot of letterpress print shops out there. And they'll do some commercial work. Like they'll do some Christmas cards for people. They'll do business cards, they'll do some type of marketing pieces, and each print shop's a little different. Some really want to design their own stuff and hand set type with lead type or wood type and lock it all together, and that's way too old school for me. And
mm-hmm.
and then you'll have, so you've got one thought that they all they want to do is do that, and that's cool, but it's like locking up. If you enjoy sorting Legos, That's perhaps your dream job.
That's the road for you.
Exactly. So using photopolymer, it's like it's quicker, it's faster, and we develop our own plates in-house, and we develop plates for other people too.
So the distinction here is mm-hmm. like if you're working with lead type, you literally have these like tiny pieces of type, these letters, and you're going to construct them into this like box structure, and that will be the surface that you print, as opposed to the photopolymer technique where you take a digital image and then you expose it and create this like polymer that has those raised surfaces, and then you use that to print, and like it's one piece.
Very well described. It's the polymer plate is basically like a rubber stamp, but it's the durometer, that the hardness of it is a lot harder. And it's almost, in our machines, it acts almost as hard as like a magnesium plate. Like mm-hmm. a magnesium metal plate, of course, is going to last much longer, but you're stuck with that bit of metal on a block of wood forever until you throw it away or melt it down or something. Whereas the mm-hmm. polymer plate is really thin, it's small, and you can. Once you're through with the job, you could put it in a little envelope, a 9x12 envelope, job jacket. You could neatly file it away, and you could store 50 to 100 of those in the box versus mm-hmm. the magnesium plate, which just takes up space.
Right.
So our shop is aimed primarily at solving creative problems for advertising firms, graphic design firms, and we do a lot of weddings too. People come to us with their wedding designs, and we make plates, print for them. And so we do a little bit of everything. And now we're starting to do a little retail just because, you know, we have all these machines, and why not make some fun stuff?
Yeah, and I imagine that you don't always get all of your resources lined up perfectly so that your jobs perfectly match, you know, the hours that you have available. So doing maybe a little retail project or I saw some of the fine art projects that you guys do can kind of fit in between the margins of the commercial work.
Yeah, it's we don't have any anchor clients, and a lot of companies will have anchor clients that gives them steady work. And so when you don't have anchor clients, you're on like a sine wave up and down with work. It's either yeah. you know, sink or swim. And it used to freak me out the first couple of years because you never know, you know, if you can pay your employees, yada yada. So mm-hmm. it's nice to just be able to chill and say, hey, we got these ideas we've been talking about for a couple months. Let's just get them done.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So what are some of the retail projects that you're working on?
Well, not to plug ourselves on your show and my wife's show, but
I think that's exactly what we're doing here. I think that's the whole thing.
Well, it's been interesting because I don't have a retail background. My parents aren't in business. You know, my dad's a retired accountant. My mom's a retired nurse. So the idea of doing retail is all relatively new to me, right? So mm-hmm. Making some of the fun things. Well, getting back to the voice, I think you were talking about the voice of each community and finding, like, what kind of art each person is that would make is authentic to them.
Mm-hmm.
I look at a lot of the other print shops, and some specialize in concert posters, some specialize in, you know, country music stuff, some do hand cut stuff. Everybody's got their own aesthetic, and it's kind of been simmering in the background, but I realize that nerd culture is really my forte. That's my tribe, that's people I relate to. And last year I was out with a friend of mine named Brian Fife, and we were in some game shop, and he was pointing out a 20-sided dice he wanted to buy for his son for Christmas. It was a big quote-unquote executive toys about the size of a golf ball, and he's like, oh, my son will love that. And I thought, this is my people, he understands me. And I was like, oh my god, I gotta print this thing. And it's just like, hey, let's make some coasters, you know. It's like, how can I apply
yeah.
nerd culture to paper? And it's because there's a limited market. So we did some D20 coasters, and if people understood it, if they didn't understand it, that's okay. But the people who understood it, it's like, yes, you're my target. That's my market.
Yeah, that's like yeah. the it's like all the way down, like the overlap of letterpress, which in and of itself, like, that's pretty niche. And then, like, we're gonna really hone in on the letterpress geek market.
Exactly. It's like if they never sell it, I don't care, because I made them. I wanted to get them out of my system, and they look badass. And I'm just like, okay, I'm cool
yeah.
with that.
Yeah. It's the Neil Gaiman advice that, like, make work that you love, and then even if it doesn't end up paying you very much, you still have the work.
Exactly. Last year, I guess it was last year, we had an intern, and we arrived at the same time, And she saw me sitting in my car. I hadn't gone in the shop yet. She's rapping on the windows, and she's like, what are you sitting here for? And I was reading all the Facebook posts about the Supreme Court ruling for allowing gay marriages. And I was just like, we got to do something about this. And she's like, what do you want to do? I'm like, Jesus, I don't know. Let's make a poster. And we'd never done anything like that on the spot. So she laid out the type, and we've got a printer. We just like printed off some film and made a plate in-house and had it printed by like 1 o'clock that afternoon. It was, I'd never made any art like that in a long time. And it was really fulfilling just to be very spontaneous to do something that was really cool.
Yeah, when I first, I think when Anna and I started working together, and she mentioned your shop, and I looked you guys up on Instagram, that was one of the things that just caught my eye immediately. It's a real simple but super iconic design, and I think it's also really well suited to like what you have to offer, like the way that you ink the plate, like you do this gradient from, it's like this rainbow gradient, and I think I saw a video somewhere of you guys inking the machine to get ready to print them. And it's just like, this is a thing that only we could do, you know, this is what we have uniquely to contribute.
I guess letterpress is great for doing those rainbow rolls where you put a bunch of different ink on the cylinder and you can achieve all those colors at the same time. And it was fun to do, and it was a technically challenged to do on my Heidelberg windmill, because it's, the Heidelberg windmill has an inking cylinder maybe almost 15 inches long, and it's not really geared for that, because the inking cylinder moves back and forth left to right like a typewriter barrel, and so it's made to move back and forth, so you get a completely smooth single coating of ink on the plate. And I had to disassemble a couple things so it wouldn't move, and it would just deliver the colors where I needed to. Totally geeky, sorry I'm nerding it on this thing.
No, it was that's a lot of great fun.
So that's kind of a retail thing we did. Recently we did, we've done, a couple years ago, I sent out some Christmas cards to my clients, and they got such a good response. People are like, dude, you need to retail this. And I'm like, all right, what the hell? So we've done some of that. So they're not very specifically like, we're going into retail, like, doing all this stuff. It's just, there's this kind of happenstance.
Yeah, right? stuff that makes sense.
We had, last tale about this, we had, recently we did a job for a client, and sometimes we have to outsource particular parts of the production to another printer to do. Like in this case, we needed to send out a bunch of paper to get some good solids, and we had to send this work out to an offset printer. And as a result, the offset guys used a ton of paper, a lot more than I needed for the job. And we had them in the house, and they had these brown squares on one side and it was white on the other, and it was a ton of paper. It was expensive paper. I couldn't really use it for the job because the color was inconsistent, but it was like, let's make something fun out of this. And we'd been talking about crappy drivers and, you know, leaving them notes under the windshield, and it's like, you got this brown on one side, white on the other, let's make a little poopy emoji on one side, a little message on the flip side. I don't care if they sell. It was fun to do. We've got this cool paper, and we got this ridiculous little, you know, anyway, that was kind of fun
too. You blank like shit. Have a nice exactly. Day.
So that's some of the fun stuff we do, but primarily, you know, one of the questions I know you guys want to talk about is commercial printing and how to purge printers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we can talk about commercial printing for a bit, and then if you want to talk some more about fine art printing, I'm totally game for that too.
Well, we thought that since we had you here, we could talk about if people wanted to contact a commercial printer, they have something that they want to have printed, what's the best way to approach a commercial printer?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like, what, you know, what kind of questions should they ask?
Sure.
You know, because these are the kinds of questions like, and, you know, as a commercial printer, I'm sure you get a lot of people asking you questions that are, you know, are not having all of, you know, not asking all of the questions and you kind of having to fill in details for people, or, you know, knowing when people come to you and not necessarily having all of the information, and you being like, okay, these are the other things that you're probably going to need to ask me. So here, let me lay it out for you.
I think one thing to keep in mind is if you're ever approaching a manufacturer such as a printer or any commercial thing, I would like to go in there with an open mind and just ask any questions, even if they're ridiculous. And if the vendor you're talking with isn't giving you good information, or he's very reticent or she's very reticent, you don't want to deal with that vendor. And everybody who comes to us, yeah, everybody has a different set of skills, a different set of knowledge, and I can never assume that. But a lot of people are a little reticent to show their hand, or they don't want to come off as not knowing enough. So as a result, they don't ask the right questions. And usually we get a lot of questions like, are people approach a commercial printer like they have a budget and they want to know the per piece cost. And it's a little impossible for, yeah, we can give you a per piece cost, but it's much more beneficial to you and us if you talk about your, like maybe your whole project first.
Mm-hmm.
Many print shops, and definitely with letterpress print shops who've got websites, they all have an FAQ, and everybody's FAQ is pretty much the same thing because we all get asked the same questions because nobody knows how to approach a letterpress printer these days, and they ask a lot of the same questions. And I'll send you my link that you can put up, but Firecracker Press has a great site. Studio on Fire has a great site. They're all kind of the same. But the thing to, I think, I would love for this conversation to take away is, I think most printers aren't there to screw you out of every cent that you have. It's like, so I think, and it's because I get that, like, I understand how, like, mechanics price things. Generally, it's like, hey, the parts are cheap. You're paying me for the labor. You're paying me right. for having done this for 25, 30 years. So that's something to keep in mind. A lot of people try to cut corners and bring in or offer to bring in their own paper. And they're like, hey, I already bought this 5x7 piece of paper. How much is it going to cost for you to print on it? And all of a sudden, the price went up exponentially because you've just created a ton of work for a printer. It happens a lot. And we try to, a lot of times, it's just like, it's going to be much cheaper for you to keep that paper. Let us buy paper and do it right the first time. If you're printing at home, sure, you can cut your own stuff down and it makes sense. But our machines will handle a 10 by 13 inch piece of paper easy. And we can put three, like, take a wedding, for instance. You'll have an invitation, an RSVP, and a map generally. That's three items that we could squeeze into one piece of paper and print all at the same time. But a lot of times we'll have clients who'll bring us in, hey, here's my invitation. I already got some cut paper for that, some cut paper for the map, the cut paper for the invitation for the, you know, the RSVP.
Yeah.
And that means you have to set up the plate three times, you know, and it's they've just tripled the labor. You know, they're trying to save, you know, $20 on paper, you know, and it's just not working out. So go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so I think the kind of takeaway that I'm thinking about is, like, come, if you know that your project is going to have a strong printing component, come to a printer early with parameters for the project and let them help you design the specifics in a way that's going to be easiest for the printer and most cost effective for you. Like if you have, like, your design and your paper and it's bought and it's cut and you know, like, here's a big vat of ink that I mixed up and, like, could you do all this for me? It's like, it seems like that you're doing a lot of the work for the printer, but it's just going to make the job more difficult if you come with, like, too many things nailed down. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we solve a lot of problems for clients. They'll bring us some projects and we'll discuss options, and a lot of times I know they'll have a smaller budget and I'll suggest digital printing or offset, and sometimes I'll just tell them the project's not right for letterpress, which is, you know, always hard to turn down work, but it's the best thing for everybody. You don't want to overpromise anything.
Yeah. Yeah, that's no fun. And yeah, it's not a universal medium. You know, it's not the right solution for every problem.
Right. So, getting down to brass tacks, how to approach design or commercial printer? Yeah, if you talk to a salesperson, sometimes they're going to want to squeeze out some more cash, you know. And if you're getting a price from a salesperson, bear with them. Just tell the same thing. You tell them everything, because these guys know way more about printing than I will ever know. I've got a friend, and he has a degree in print production, which I had no idea existed. And he knows, oh man, the more I learn about printing, the more I know I don't know. So a lot of
that's how lithography is for me. I'm like, somewhere over there in that corner, they put chemicals on flat plates and make prints, but I'm not going to wander too closely because it's just going to confuse me more.
I was talking to one of my ink manufacturers today. There's an ink place in town, and when you go to meet these guys and pick up your ink, they just look like, you know, ink jockeys. They're wearing like, you know, the zip-up unitard suit, right? And there's ink all over them. They look like, you know, they could be like changing oil for a living. But you talk to these guys and they start dropping chemical terms left and right, and you realize, oh, these guys know what they're talking about. It's not just like mixing A and B to get C. It's very, there's just so much chemical knowledge to be had. And the same, all right, getting back to the salespeople, a lot of salespeople have been there a long time, because they know, you need to go here for this, you need to go there for that. Here, just tell me about your whole project and we'll get it taken care of. So, yeah, cool. That's the best way to approach a job, rather than I've got $5 to spend, you know.
Yeah. So I think that is like a good scope for our first conversation. I think another thing that we are interested in is talking about like ways to get started with printmaking at your house.
Sure.
You know, if you don't have access to a big gangly crazy metal machine. But I think that you and Anna have some hometown business to attend to this evening, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh yeah,
The hometown in our heart.
Yeah, your heart hometown.
Yeah, we got to go make sure that the Cubbies win the World Series. No offense to anybody from Cleveland, but...
Yeah, full offense to everyone from Cleveland, because if anybody from, the American Central Division is going to win the World Series, it will be the Tigers, and I will have nothing else.
All right,
well, thank you again to our sponsor, Art Snacks, for their support this week. Be sure to check them out, get a monthly subscription going, or maybe take a look at the new studio collection. If you want to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at artsupplyposse.com/21. We are Art Supply Posse in all the places you would expect to find us. And if you have a burning question, you can submit it to us via #AskASP. Our intro music and our outro music is created by Bob Atkins, the same Bob.
I don't know what you're talking. Have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, so I suppose this isn't your first appearance. You have been with us from the beginning.
Always in spirit.
Yeah. So thanks to Bob not only for the music but also for being on the show tonight. And
it was so delightful. Thank you for having me. I'm sorry I rambled. And I promise I'll slow down and drink some decaf for the next show.
No problem. And everybody else, have a good night, and go Cubs.
Good night, Posse. Go Cubbies!